So there we go. So today we're going to be looking at ancient art and the Egyptians. I thought I'd cram them all into one because they're two very, very fascinating topics. But I think they work better as a duo, even though they're quite sort of quite separate. I think they work better than a duo as they do as separate lectures. The Egyptians are a fascinating civilization in that they simultaneously contain all of the sort of emergent and interesting elements of the kind of the ancient art, the most ancient arts, whilst also being their own unique thing, a particular civilization arisen around the idea of order and structure and kind of pure line and style. So we'll look first at ancient art, some of the underlying ideas of ancient art and the things that tie it together. And when we're talking about ancient and primordial art, we're looking at things that are so far back in time that they are kind of evidence for themselves. We don't have as many kind of, there's no written language, there's no pre-existing other elements that we can compare them to. We tend to find them in and of themselves in the ground, occasionally with little bits of other evidence like evidence of fire, evidence of fish bones if it's near fishing centres, but they tend to be self-contained bits of art, and so we tend to explain them all in similar ways using evidence gained where we can. So you tend to find that ancient arts around the world have very common elements, but also they help to explain each other. So a lot of work was done in the 20th century in the Amazon rainforest, where there were still hunter-gatherers, collecting information about hunter-gatherer societies. And so we use that to try and explain hunter-gatherer societies in the ancient past in the hope that they are similar in some way. And again, we have artists like Aboriginal Australians who create Dreamtime images, which are kind of very similar in the way that they work to ancient images we found in caves. And so we hope that by looking at one and hearing the explanation of one from living artists, we can use it to explain things in the past, because otherwise we just would have no idea what was going on. With the Egyptians, things get more sophisticated. We have a recognisable Egyptian style. I'm sure you'll recognise the sort of headdresses, and we have hieroglyphics that we can understand, so written language. We have this idea of the origin of our ancient art emerging into something that's more developed, and that becomes increasingly complex and quite confusing as it becomes this layer upon layer upon layer of religious overtones, of ceremonial overtones, of, I guess the Egyptians are they're a highly advanced society that is so utterly different to our own that we can see in it shades of our own, whilst appreciating how kind of distant it is from us. So, yeah, we'll go through the origin and function of art, to Paleolithic art, to Egyptian art, and the idea of order, proportion, and measurement. So we'll return quickly to the Lascaux Caves, where we were a second ago. So this image, as we know, but it's got some really fascinating artistic points to it. It's clearly produced by people who are quite skilled. It's estimated to be around 35,000 years old, based upon the sort of bones and relics of fire that we've found there. As you can see, I think it helps to see it in its location in the cave here. Because when you're in the cave, you can sort of get a sense that it's not simply a blank bit of wall. We're projecting it here as a JPEG on a flat bit of wall, which makes it have the illusion of being a typical artwork. But in fact, it looms over you. It's gigantic as well, like there's a guy. So this is about the size of me here. It's a gigantic artwork. It looms over you and it's high up as well. So it's kind of up at a ceiling height. It's also inside a dark cave. So in a dark cave, it's going to have certain lighting conditions, there's going to be certain conditions in which you see the images. That's what's preserved it for so long. So whether they had these images outside the cave, we have no way of knowing because we've lost all of that stuff. But they're certainly associated with caves. And I think when you see all the animals rushing around, the way that they're laying on top of each other, you get this sense of the conditions in which they're seen are part of the work itself. As I mentioned before, an artwork, you tend to think about it as an object, a self-contained thing. this isn't necessarily the case in the ancient past. Instead, it's human beings transforming their environment, trying to give themselves power over their environment through the changes that they enact upon it. They placed images on this wall in order to create some kind of special function. And if you think about the conditions for it, they'll have had a fire going, likely there would have been music, storytelling, dance. You can imagine the movement of various figures. Maybe they came back here in winter when it was cold and they needed somewhere to hide out and they would be worried and they need something to keep their spirits up. Maybe they were doing it in order to go in and commune with spirits. There's often a kind of association with the earth and dark places of the earth as being somewhere where gods and spirits hide. It could also be that they came back here in celebration when they'd, you know, taken down one of these big animals and they brought it back and they were cutting it up and butchering it and eating the flesh and having a big celebration and a feast. Whichever one of these it is, there's a lot of flickering lights, there's a lot of smoke, there's a lot of movement, and you're having shadows moving along the wall, and you're having a lot of light and smoke moving along the wall, and all of this movement that is there latent in the imagery must have been amped up tenfold until this seemed like a scene of lots of animals moving around and had this kind of magical quality to it. When we think about the way that art worked in ancient times, we tend to associate it with this idea of magical thinking, that there is something about us creating images that gives us power over those images, that the relation, that human beings' relationship to images is like our relationship to the world. The world is this big complex thing, and we reduce it to its important points. We reduce it to outlines, in the case here, and we reduce it to kind of basic shapes. There's even a suggestion that it might have been that one of the tribal practices would have been to have all the hunters get together and have these animals up there, and they could kind of do songs and dance and tell stories of great hunters, and then they could point the sticks at them and kind of stab them in a way of a kind of totemistic way, associate with what we call homoeopathic magic, which is this idea of two things that are associated, I guess, imaginatively, having a real life connection. There wasn't that modern scientific separation of cause and effect physically from cause and effect mentally. And we can understand homoeopathic magic because we kind of still have that as a remnant in our thinking today, when you have your favorite pen or when you have your lucky charm, that when you lose it, you know, something bad's gonna happen. That connection between two, you know, physically unconnected things is a powerful force in the human imagination. And 35,000 years ago, these are Homo sapiens. These are people who are biologically no different from us. They might have different ways of thinking about the world, different cultures, different language, but they have no physical differences. Certainly when they're younger, I think they wouldn't have lived as long probably, and things like that. But yeah, these are skilled artists who are essentially, yeah, no different from us. You can also see on some of these older, less preserved, admittedly, this is a less preserved example from a different cave, you can see the way that human beings interacted with these images. So here we've got the famous handprints. You find lots of these handprints with ancient artworks. It's with that blowgun effect again. You sort of chew up some charcoal or bits from the fire and you put your hand on the wall, you blow against it, and you create this hand image on the wall. Some art historians think that this is like the example of the first signature, but I'm not really sure about that. I don't think that people at this time would really understand what a signature would have any relevance to, because there's no idea of property, so why would you want to own a picture? I think instead it's an attempt to physically connect the soul of the artist or the creator of the image to that world of the image itself. You've created this world of images, and creating images gives you a power over them because of that homoeopathic connection. And breath in the ancient world is the idea of life. You see this even with the Egyptians. They had the book of breathing, which was the book of life. And when you breathe out, that's your breath kind of bringing your life out. And so by blowing onto your hand, you're essentially putting your life onto that, using the power of breath. They used to think, in fact, you know when your cat sits on your chest and kind of stares at you? They used to think that that was the cat trying to steal your breath and kill you, so they used to get rid of. Yeah, they didn't trust cats. But this is this connection to the world of images. So that turns art into a type of tool, essentially. Art is another hunting tool. There's another fascinating ancient sculpture. This is the oldest bit of sculpture that exists that we know about, that we've managed to find. This is called the Willendorf Venus. This one's a bit newer, although all that's relative. This is from about 15,000 BC. The Willendorf Venus has had loads of different interpretations. If you look at any history of art, there's going to be some kind of bit about the Willendorf Venus. Yeah, it's the earliest human carving. It was originally read as being a kind of Mother Earth figure, that it's kind of overflowing, its abundance of flesh is a kind of sense of nature being all abounding, being something that, if you can imagine, if you're a hunter-gatherer, you never sure where the next meal is coming from. And so having a kind of mother god that's always generous, is kind of overflowing, and is very fecund, is a useful thing to have. There was also the idea that it might be a sort of mother goddess to do with birth power, that it's a kind of, they call them fetish objects, a kind of, that if you interacted with the object, it would give you some of its power. And there was also the idea that it might be a kind of model of the ideal woman, that this might have been some kind of sculpture to kind of idealize woman, create the ideal image of a woman, which is someone who has got a lot of access to food and of resources. And this idea that comes through at certain times in history of people who are have extra weight being a symbol of their kind of safety and security, and of the life that goes with that, that this is a kind of ideal figure. A key to understanding it, I think, comes from this weird head, which you've no doubt noticed. So the head has this kind of weird round thing. There's no face on it. There's lots of little knobbly bits on it. It's surprisingly difficult to find any image that will blow up and retain its kind of... This is a 4K image and you can still see there's lots of noise in it, so apologies that I've not been able to find... I spent all summer trying to find high-def images and I still can't find them high-def enough to survive the projector. But yeah, there's different readings of this. So one reading is that if this is a nature, a kind of embodiment of nature, then that nature is blind. That's a kind of symbolic reading, that nature is this kind of, is this body that gives us things, but it doesn't have any personality or head. That's one of the suggestions, although it's a bit abstract. Another interpretation is that these might be souls. These might be little, every little circle might be a kind of human soul, and that this is a mother goddess that's waiting to give birth and release all of these souls into the world, that there's a kind of sacred motherhood that's the source of all being, and that we're all kind of floating around as souls waiting to go through. Another suggestion, which is a bit more practical, is that it's a beehive, and this is a kind of bee woman, and the bees has always been a symbol of kind of busyness and industry, but also of kind of plenty. You know, honey is sweet. Honey was the form of kind of getting sweetness before sugar came along. And so this idea that it's connected to bees, and again, that's nature being plentiful and sweet and things like that. But the most interesting idea I've found to do with the Willendorf Venus was, I think it was only a couple of years ago, a paper was published on it, and that reads this head as a handle. And the reason that one is quite so interesting is that it suggests that not only is this meant to be held rather than just looked at like a passive art object which we'd see today, it's a practical tool that's picked up by the hand, and that also it was possibly carved by pregnant women. And that would explain the kind of exaggerated features of it, because if you stand in a first-person perspective and look down at your body, it gives you a foreshortening. You know, your belly always looks bigger to you than it does to other people, and your legs kind of taper off into nothing because they're all the way down there. And you get this effect of you looking down at yourself. And the suggestion is they held the head of the sculpture and they sculpted it whilst looking down at themselves as the model. Because this is before mirrors, so, you know, you'd have to sculpt... To sculpt yourself, you'd have to do it first person, I suppose. And I like this idea because it ties to this sense of... Images working as a tool, as a way of transferring properties between different people, such that you might think, if one of these has been carved, it's likely that there were probably hundreds, if not thousands, of them carved. Because for something to survive this long, it tends to be, there has to have been more than one of them. So it might have been a relatively common cultural practice of its time for pregnant women to make these carvings, and then perhaps women who wanted to get pregnant could be given these carvings, and they could look at the image of the sculpture holding the head as a handle, look down at themselves, and it would somehow impart the image from one thing to the image of the other, therefore being a sort of, I guess, feminine counterpoint to the hunter who makes a picture of a big elk and then stabs it in the hope that that will give him the power to stab a full elk. So this ties it into this whole idea of images and power and the self. So if we look at some of the other ancient arts to do with the totem now, we can see how this carries through, this idea of images changing the person. So totemism is a particular kind of belief system that we associate it most with Native American totems, because they have totem poles and totem animals very famously. This one is from the Haida tribe. But it's a kind of general association that you see in a lot of hunter-gatherer societies of either the whole tribe or particular people in the tribe get given a totem animal, and that is they then have a kind of special relationship with that animal. It's a relationship that kind of means that they can't kill that animal, for example, but that animal can't kill them in their belief structure. So in the Trois-Frères caves from around 15,000 BC, mangled that one, in France, we have the famous deer man, who's baffled a lot of people, but this seems to be an example of a very early depiction of a kind of imagining of a spirit animal, of a human being who is of the totemic kind of deer clan. And so he's part deer, he's part human. And we have this today in the Chambri people of the who have ritual scarification. Now this is the next level of totem animal, where their totem animal is the crocodile, which is a useful thing if you live near a river that's full of crocodiles. Crocodiles are pretty terrifying, so that if you become a member of the crocodile clan, you become a brother of the crocodile can't hurt you, is the belief. And so what they do is they get some sharp sticks that they then make dirty, and they... Question?
Kind of reminds me of the character from the Marvel movie Black Panther, who scars himself every time he kills someone. It's a bit like...
Yeah, ritual scarification is practiced all over Africa in different ways. The particular crocodile one is to do with the crocodile relationship. But you have the old singer Seal, who I don't know if you're familiar with, did Kiss with a Rose. He has scarification on his face. But it's a common practice in Africa now. It used to be common across the world. We can find it in lots of ancient kind of bodies. But they jam this sort of... it's dirty intentionally because it raises these welts, and the welts scab over and the scabs become scars. And so they jab it into the back in these patterns, and it gives them scars that make them look like a crocodile. And they don't just do that because, you know, at least that'd be pretty horrible to just stand there stabbing someone. So they build it into this whole cultural kind of practice where you've got the stories of the old ways, the relationship to the crocodile. They'll have songs, dances, there'll be some drugs involved, as there tends to be, which you would hope so, to be honest, because if I was going to get stabbed, I'd want something to ease the pain. And it becomes part of the entire culture together, it's part of the story of it, and you get marked out as part of it. This is something that we have to understand when we're looking at ancient art, is that it's part of wider practices. We can't think of it as something that sits there in the British Museum on its plinth with a little thing telling us what to think about it. When we find things like tonga drums and, you know, different types of the Ashanti breasted drum, all famous types of drums, or in the case of Incan Kwipu, this is part of, turns out that the knots that are tied in it are part of a secret sort of mathematical language, which we've only just discovered. But all of these individual elements form part of a whole performance, a whole event. African masks are often, when you often see them, they're presented as just a mask on their own, a kind of stone mask. But whenever we see something like that, you have to think, well, what's the other things that were worn with it? So yeah, you have a stone mask, but in this case, they have modern day African masks. Most of the equipment that you're seeing there, the whole of the costume, the drums, the musical instruments, all the things associated with the mask ritual, they're going to probably have rotted away within the space of a year, 2 years. So when you see African masks or any of these sort of ancient symbolic things made of stone or metal, it's likely that they were surrounded by lots of other things as well and formed part of a ritual that told the story of of that civilization. Dreamtime images, I mentioned earlier, these are examples of modern Australian Aboriginal art. These are fascinating because they give you a sense of, they have a kind of occult meaning. Hidden meanings are buried within them. They look to us like abstract patterns, but there is a certain way of reading them which reveals both an inner kind of spiritual geography, but also a geography associated with the landscape. So if you live somewhere like Australia, where it's very difficult to get around because it's seemingly just a desert and there's very little water, very little in the way of things to eat, making these complicated patterns that are given to them in the dream time is sort of useful, I think. And so when we're looking at ancient art, we can understand that there's great levels of complexity often hidden in these things. So as human beings move towards bigger societies, we can see how the images shift, the images change, human beings start entering these images. There's a suggestion that we've done research that suggests that the average person can hold about 100, can remember the names of about 100 people. You can have about 100 friends and family who are like part of your circle, and then you can kind of maintain a general awareness of about 500 people. And from that, we've come to a conclusion that it's very likely that this is the kind of biological size of a human tribe. So that human tribes can get to about 100 people, and then they have to split into two tribes of 50. And that those tribes can coexist with maybe four or five other tribes. But after that, once you get more than 500 people, it starts to feel like too many people. We can no longer conceptualize or hold that many people in our heads, which would suggest that at that point, some of those tribes are going to have to keep moving. And so based on that evidence, we presume that's why Homo sapiens have moved all the way around the Earth, is because we have a certain inbound limit on how many people we can be around before we have to then keep moving. In hunter-gatherer days, that would have been really useful evolutionarily, because humans, you know, eat a lot of food. We do a lot of damage. And so if you've got 500 people all fighting over a small patch of ground, you're going to run out of food really quick. And so there's probably an evolutionary reason we can't know as many people as that. But this led to problems when suddenly in Mesopotamia, in the Golden Triangle, for whatever reason, people started to grow crops. We realized that if you put a seed in the ground, food comes out of it. And that this way, we don't have to go hunting for food. We can simply just be patient, put seed in the ground. As long as, you know, we get nice weather, food comes out of the ground. Suddenly we have the birth of farming and agriculture, and animal husbandry, where we can have animals that stay around as domesticated animals. Suddenly we have a constant source of food. Once you have that, you move out of a tribal culture into a society that can support many different people. And when we start getting these societies, we start getting new forms of art. So this here is the Sumerian Standard of Ur, which is a cool name, from around 3000 BC. So this is overlapping a little bit with the early Egyptians. The Standard of Ur is really important, though, as a kind of transition period from ancient art that gave us a kind of religious view of the world, a view of the world based upon kind of our raw interaction with it, into depicting our own society. It's essentially attempting to create a structure for looking at the world. And so up at the top of the Standard of Ur, we have these big figures who are the kings, who are the high priests, and who are the generals. This chap sat down, is surrounded by all of his civil servants, and his sort of, they're drinking wine, so we've got our nobles, and up here we've got generals and sort of wise men. People at the top of that pyramid, they're important. We then beneath them have the knights, who are standing here with their swords, ready to do battle, and we have people down here, like the traders, people creating things, we've got the farmers, people who own things, rich people who are, there are more of them because they're further down the pyramid, but they're more important than these people at the bottom, who are kind of the people following, just the everyday soldiers, the people following the army. Or down here we've got, you know, these are basically the slaves, the serfs, the peasants, whichever role they're playing. But they're carrying things, they're digging, they're having the horrible lives of kind of grinding poverty. But at the bottom of the pyramid, there's the most of them. There is more of people at the bottom than there is at the top, and right at the top you've got one big guy. And so this is an attempt to use physical space to map out a kind of political geography, that by depicting people in relationship to each other spatially, we've also reflected how we should feel about them in a society. And it's through images like this that people came to understand how they related to each other in more than just those kind of tribal ways, that there's something bigger and that there's these larger structures. Now, in terms of how we think about the world and the religious kind of foundations of it, we can see this reflected in the movement from animism through pantheism to polytheism, a movement from kind of relating to the world as it is to relating to characters, kind of exaggerated characters. So animism, this is a Persian, by the way, in case you're wondering what's going on in here. Animism is essentially the religious form of life associated with hunter-gatherers. In animism, everything has a soul. So the world consists of large amounts of souls all running around. A river has a soul, a rock has a soul. An animal has a soul, and then you kill it, and you say thank you to the animal and its soul for providing sustenance for you because you've got a soul. Even your weapons have souls, and the air has a soul. And there's just lots of individual little souls all running around. This sort of shifts when we move towards agriculture and sort of living in a sustained way, because a hunter-gatherer is always on the move trying to find things. Once you start planting seeds and waiting for things to grow, you start noticing that there's, you know, the year, sometimes it goes cold, but when it goes cold, after a little while, it goes warm again. You have this idea of seasons and cycles, this continuation, that there's something that keeps life going on, and you're very thankful for that because, you know, you have to place your trust in that continuation of things always happening again and again in cycles, because you have to have the trust in order to put your food in the ground instead of eating it, knowing that eventually more food will come out. And this is associated with pantheism, which is a belief that there is just a general kind of field of God. Like, God is this essence that underlies all things. You tend to hear about the world spirit or the grandfathers, a kind of world soul. And so whereas animism has lots of separate little souls running around, your pantheists are seeing the world as kind of one big entity that self-renews. Then once you develop societies that have higher up figures in them, kind of key personalities, polytheism develops out of this. And polytheism is taking all of this pre-existing stuff and conceptualizing it and kind of shoving it up in heaven, or putting it on the top of Mount Olympus, or putting it at the end of the Nile in the case of the Egyptians. It's creating gods, the first kind of fully fledged, characterized gods. And so the polytheists' gods are kind of like kings. They're people with an infinite amount of power. And the thing that a polytheist, essentially the way you relate to your gods, is to just ask them for mercy and to please don't kill me. Because there are powers beyond you that are more powerful than you that you can't comprehend, and you just have to hope that they don't turn around and get you. Now, the interesting thing with the Egyptians is that the Egyptians, this is a very complex kind of image, but it's their attempt to visualize. It's the most complete image we have of their attempt to visualize their worldview. The interesting thing with the Egyptians is that they do all three of these simultaneously. The Egyptians never had any sense of heresy, of heretics. You can never turn around and tell them, this is my idea of religion, and they would go, that is not allowed, you're only allowed this religion. Instead, they would tend to try and bolt it onto their own religion. The Egyptians, in fact, were invaded and taken over 15 separate times. So they were taken over by Libyans, by Assyrians, by, I think, there was two Ethiopians that took over. And every single time that Egypt was taken over, the enemies might have had a better army, but they didn't have a better culture. And so they simply amalgamated the culture of the invader. And within a generation, that invader was now an Egyptian. They were now a pharaoh. They were now another in the line of pharaohs. And you can see this happening with the way that they relate to it. So pantheism, that belief that there's a sort of all-abounding force field of God, this is associated with the idea of, it's called the renewer, or he or she, the renewer, the soul god underlying the Egyptian worldview, which is personified by the Nile, or by a river, depending on how you want to see it. But when they say river in Egypt, they mean the Nile. They believed that the world didn't have a beginning and end, it was simply renewed. And the renewer was this continual spirit underlying all the other religious ideas they had, and that the world was constantly being renewed over and over by the great renewer. And so when they say God in the singular, they tend to mean the renewer. who is always there underneath everything. But they also had animism, they had spirits that, you know, they had the ibis, they had the scarab, lots of spirits that could help you on your way. They still had a belief in magical animals. The cat, for example, was a kind of spirit guardian. And then they had polytheism. They had their own gods like Thoth and Set down there, Anubis, and figures like Ra, who we'll come to in a second because he's also a monotheistic god. But they had the gods with the big personalities, who had stories, who had myths, who had legends associated with them. But they had it all simultaneously. So you could simultaneously have all of the gods and magical animals and the great renewer overlapping. And eventually they even got monotheism, which you wouldn't think would be able to fit with all of them. But they did it in the form of Ra. Ra, who is the great sort of sun god, and that soul image of the sun burning down on them, we'll see a bit more of that soon. But you can see it up here. That circle later becomes the halo behind sort of religious figures, and in Buddhist tradition it remains kind of a circle, it kind of turns on its side. In Christian tradition becomes a halo. But yeah, they had this idea of there being one core god of which the other gods are elements or avatars. So their core story associated with this chap Osiris, that's Anubis treating him. So Osiris was the brother of Set, and the two of them were gonna rule all of Egypt together. But there was as there always is in these tales, there was a sort of prediction that Osiris was going to become more powerful than his brother Set. And so Set decides he's not going to let this come true, and so he hacks his brother to pieces, and he takes all the pieces of his body and he spreads them all around Egypt and around the whole world. So Horus, the father of the twins, what he does is rips out his eye and he sends his eye off. This is like the Horcruxes in Harry Potter. And this eye travels all around the world finding the missing parts of Osiris, and it brings them back together. And it turns out that the complete prediction had been that Osiris first needed to come back from the dead and then he would rule all of Egypt. So Set, who's killed his brother, has eventually set in motion this bringing back of all the body parts of Osiris. Osiris rises up, and in rising up takes on part of the spirit of Ra. He becomes partly Osiris, partly Ra. He overthrows his brother Set, boots him down into the underworld, and he becomes the living embodiment of Egypt. So this is the Eye of Horus, which you'll know is going from before. The Eye of Horus, the famous Eye of Horus, is that idea of sight being all important, that sight can bring order out of the many disparate parts that are there in the human experience. And it's only after having been totally dismantled and taken to bits and being brought back together by an all-seeing eye that Osiris could become the kind of ruler and leader that he needed to be. In fact, when you everyday Egyptians also believed that they had to follow this themselves, so that if you were rich enough to have yourself mummified, you believed that what would happen after you die is that your seven souls would split out and go around the world, and you had to have the Eye of Horus go and collect your seven souls and bring them back to you, and then you could come back into the afterlife and you would gain the name Ra or the name Osiris, depending on which version of it you like. So I would become Joe Ra, and you would then be a reinvigorated version of yourself, and you could go around. So it's a bit like Jesus dies on the cross and comes back, and so Osiris gets pulled apart and comes back. So we as people get pulled apart, and we come back after we've been reassembled by the Eye of Horus. Now, while we're thinking about cultures, civilizations, the way all these things fit together, there's a kind of useful, I think, thinker. No, green's not going to be very visible, is it? In red. There's a useful thinker that I'm going to keep returning to in this lecture series, because I think his particular way of thinking about how civilizations work is quite a useful one. It's called Oswald Spengler. He's got quite a scary name, sounds a bit fascistic, but he was German in the 1930s, but he did not like the Nazis. Oswald Spengler had an image of the way that human cultures existed, and that is that they began as societies, And societies are your bog standard collection of people. Everyone lives in a society, we all live in a society, it's just a group of people. And when you have groups of people, they all exist differently, they all have different languages, different culture, different like cultural practices, different art forms, different belief systems and things like that. But on very special occasions, you will find that one of these societies develops into what he calls a culture. And for Spengler, the difference between a society and a culture is that a culture is one of these very rare, very specific types of collections of people where every element of their existence within the world is united and makes sense compared to the rest of it. So you see this, for example, in the Golden Age of Greece. So all of those famous Greek, ancient Greeks that you'll have heard of, like Hippocrates, Plato, Socrates, Alexander the Great, they all lived within the space of two generations with each other in one city. And that's what a core example of what Spengler would call a culture, is that the language, the songs, the form of life, the religion, the stories and the art all connects and explains that society to it. So that when you're living in the middle of that culture, you feel like every single part of your life has a sort of intense sense of meaning, that you are in the right time and place, that this is the time and place to be alive. Then Spengler suggests that once you, the result of a successful culture is that it will naturally spread. It might spread initially through warfare, because you become successful and rich, and being rich buys you armies and you take over other cultures, but eventually people start to join you because they're interested in this culture. Cultures give a sense of meaning and purpose which a normal society won't do. And so they rise up and become civilizations. And civilizations are great, huge, clunking things, big empires. You know, the Egyptians began as a couple of cities and then they grew and expanded and expanded and expanded. Cairo and Alexandria became huge cities, bigger than anything that human beings had ever built before. It went all the way down to Ethiopia in the south, Libya in the east, across to the Gulf, with something like the Roman Empire or some of the high points of Chinese civilization. You've got huge, vast areas that are covered by, you know, the whole known world is ruled by these civilizations. But the kicker for Spengler, the reason that it's his theory is so interesting, is he suggests that the downfall of a civilization is written in its culture. So a culture's success is premised upon it being a perfect fit with its time and place, but there will therefore be weaknesses in it. And as it grows bigger and larger, it ossifies, it becomes unable to change, and the weaknesses that were there at the start become so overemphasized, that's the fall of the culture. And we see this perfectly embodied in the Egyptians, because the Egyptian culture is kind of exactly what you would want as someone living in the Nile, living under a totalitarian pharaoh. It's a society based on slaves and hard work and religious belief that there is no progress, it's simply time repeats itself and we walk from living to dead and dead to living over and over again. And there's a timelessness to it, a sense that things are built to be eternal. So as a result, you get very early on this huge explosion of Egyptian culture. And then you've got, well, depends how you interpret it, but perhaps up to 5,000, 6,000 years of no change. The art style in early Egypt and the art style in late Egypt, thousands of years apart, does not change. The language does not change. It remains exactly the same as it was. And this is a key example of a civilization where everything is ossified, it's become too big, it can't change, and so civilization collapses and falls back into a series of societies. In the case of the Egyptians, it's the appearance of the Romans. Mark Antony comes and invades, and Cleopatra seems to be winning him over. And this is an old, an old ancient tale of Egypt, is the foreigner comes, takes over, then becomes Egyptian themselves. And as Mark Antony decides, actually, I might prefer being a pharaoh to a Roman, then Julius Caesar comes and kills him and kills her and burns down the library of Alexandria, because the Romans had the idea of progress, which the Egyptians didn't have. And so because there was no sense of progress for the Egyptians, that was the end of their civilization. So we can see this idea of culture and of civilization in the core symbolism of Egypt. So Egypt is, and the civilization of Egypt, the culture of Egypt, is premised upon two miracles. The first miracle being that the Nile floods every year. The Nile moves from the south to the north, and every year a flood comes. They didn't know why, they didn't know how, but the land flooded, and then that flood retreated, and then they had super fertile soil that could grow vast amounts of food on what was essentially a desert. The entirety of, you know, Egyptian civilization took place on these narrow strips either side of the Nile that depended upon that yearly miracle. And then you had the everyday miracle of the sun coming up and going down that started in the east and it set in the west. In fact, they believed that their pharaoh controlled this. The pharaoh's job, one of his many jobs, was to come out every morning and welcome up, or appear to bring the sun up. So, you know, you couldn't ever be hung over as an emperor, because you'd have to wake up before the sun every day to bring it up. And people watched you bring the sun up, and the emperor brought the sun up. And that was the second miracle. They didn't know why the sun came up, or why when it went away it came back again. But this sends south to north, east to west, creates a cross. And we can see at the top there, we've got the cross, which is and the idea of the line. So lines are very, very important in Egyptian art. And we have the circle, the sense of recurrence, of things coming around and around and around again. So in the Ankh, the symbol of holiness, rebirth, power, we have the combined elements of the cross and the circle. We'll see how the recurring problems of the path and of the circle come through. So Ra, which we mentioned before, is the equivalent of the monotheistic god of the Egyptians. He is the god of the sun, and Ra is depicted as circles, those sometimes abstract circles like this one up here, which is kind of flying in and of itself, and sometimes it's on the head of his kind of god embodiment, which is a falcon because it flies. And that round circle shows a continuous, like ever continuous circle of things recurring over and over and over again, giving a sense of continuation and also of kind of harmony and unity, that the circle is complete in and of itself. It doesn't require anything else, and everything else is simply an emanation of that one god. Another thing, I'm going to get sidetracked a bit here, but you'll notice loads and loads of gold whenever they depict Ra, or in fact in almost all ancient art there's a lot of gold used. Gold was sort of associated with Ra because gold is one of the, possibly the only metal that can't be mixed with other metals. That's why they wanted to create it as an alchemist as well in the medieval times, because gold is the most pure metal. It's the one that you can't reduce to anything else. It's one of the most pure elements, certainly the most pure metallic element. And so it's very, you can't really produce it. It's also worth bearing in mind that gold was incredibly rare. Until the vast amounts of gold were found in South America, you can't really consider how, like nowadays gold is everywhere. Like, you know, your parents might have gold wedding rings, you might own some gold jewelry. Because after all the gold was brought over from South America, gold has been quite common. But back in these days, gold is so unbelievably rare, you'd be lucky to ever see it in your life if you were a normal peasant. If you went to see the emperor and he was covered in gold, it would be an unbelievable sight. It'd be so rare to see. And we also can't appreciate gold in the modern era because of this thing that's happening here, which is electric light. Gold has a really special quality of refraction, so that when you see it in an evening, or what it would have been very commonly seen in the, under candlelight, it kind of has this liquid, kind of warm liquid quality to it that makes it, that's the way that you ought to see gold, is under candlelight, because it really has this special magical liquid quality to it. When you kind of do this and just blast it with electric light, white light, it takes all of the magic out of it, and you kind of think it looks a little bit, you know, cheesy having everything gold, especially when you see some of the Baroque stuff you'll see later, there's just giant gold things. They look dead, you know, ostentatious. It's worth bearing in mind that's the conditions that they would have seen the gold in, which was connected to Ra. Got sidetracked a little bit there. In terms of the path, so as well as the circle, they had the idea of the path. All of their art tends to be linear. It tends to move in one direction. It's not necessarily always left to right as it is here. Sometimes it's right to left. But your life was seen as being a journey along a path. The whole of Egypt was essentially laid out on that path that's down the Nile. The Book of the Dead considers life to be a journey from the east to the western lands. And then after you die, you move from the western lands back to the east. and then you do that path, that you basically the path of the sun in your life and then your death, and you recur through that cycle over and over. And we can see this in the places that they worship. So in the Valley of the Kings, around 1500 BC that was built. Valley of the Kings looks like a big temple. It is a big temple, it's where they worshipped. But one thing that you'll notice as you look at it is that there is no kind of central place where you sit and worship, where you kind of gather together. It's not a gathering place. Their religion was not a gathering religion. So if you think of all of our kind of modern ones where you've got churches, synagogues, mosques, they all tend to be built around a sense of gathering together as a community. Whereas in ancient Egypt, it was processional. The way that you worship was by walking along a path. You processed from one place to another, playing music, holding banners, having people dressed up. And you can see the architecture includes this. So there's this huge, long path walking up here, which you would be able to have, tens of thousands of people marching up here while the rest watch. And they would march around these particular areas. You can see here an example of what it looks like inside. So it's a fantastic kind of path that's laid out, and you walk through it, seeing all of these magical, impressive, huge images go past you with lots of writing and, religion and these huge gods. And it's all part of, walking through, because life is this path that you walk through. There's also this is to do with the idea of pillars as well, pillars and obelisks. So pillars, nowadays we think of as holding, as like a structural element, they hold things up. But there's a suggestion that they might have arisen prior to being things that held things up, just as pillars themselves. Certainly we know that when you have these kind of pillars that we find in the Valley of the Kings, they aren't holding up a big roof. What they tend to be doing is creating a walkway. So you can think of them a lot more like, when you're in France and there's all those poplar trees that you go by, they always plant trees by the sides of the road because it gives you a kind of impressive walkway. That's the original function of pillars. Watch out for pillars throughout the length of this lecture series. I have a kind of pet theory that you can understand a whole culture by kind of looking what it does with its pillars. Egypt sort of fits this because its pillars mark out paths. They're not holding a roof up. Sometimes they do hold a literal roof up, but the roof is there to create part of the path. It's not to create a shelter. And later on, we see that the pillars give way to obelisks. And obelisks are fascinating because pillars do exist in other cultures of the time. In fact, if we consider other cultures of the time, there are people like the Assyrians, people like the Phoenicians, who have equally gigantic sculptures, who have pillars, who have ginormous things the way that the Egyptians did. But what they didn't ever have was an obelisk. And what they didn't have was this particular, unique Egyptian style. And I would say that this is all about this idealization of the line, the continuation from the path towards the line, the geometrical structure. Because ultimately what you're looking at when we're looking at an obelisk is it's essentially a statue not of a thing, not of a creature or of a famous ruler or of a god. It's a statue of pure geometry. It's a celebration of pure geometry, of pure line. Similarly, this kind of style that they have of everyone sort of standing there like that, there's a general sense that people have that maybe this is because it's early art and therefore they might not, have developed a very sophisticated style yet. And there's a certain truth in that. But when you compare it to stuff from Persia or from Phoenicia, where they've got much more naturalistic looking people, or even when you compare it to really ancient art, like that stuff that we saw with, from the Paleolithic times, that has a really natural flow to it. There is no flow and there is no rhythm to Egyptian art. Instead, there is this worship of the pure line of like geometry, straightness. They carry very straight staffs with nothing on the end. There's a sense that this kind of sense of proportion, of bringing things down to their mathematical, geometrical shapes, is really important. We have images that suggest that they were very advanced in terms of their understanding of structural engineering, of the way that structures came up. Some of their structures are so gigantic they could only have been made using very sophisticated, quite modern tools like protractors. They had these kind of using booms to create perfect angles on things. They have examples of ancient Egyptian calculus and things like this. So one of their early breakthroughs was that they could measure the height of a tree by measuring its shadow. So they would measure the height of a person and the height of their shadow, and then using a formula, if they measured the shadow of the tree, they could measure how tall the tree would be. By focusing on pure mathematics, which is essentially taking the chaotic world around us, the world of nature that is just unpredictable, we don't have any idea how it works, and reducing it to its most simple form, lines, numbers, that gives you control over it. It gives you a capacity to do what you want with that nature because you've made it manageable for the human mind. And so then they could do things like scale up. There's a little person down here, so you can get a good sense of how gigantic this sculpture is. It's lasted a long time, even though it's lost its face. And so the Egyptians could create such vast things because they had such a mastery of geometry and of the line. Because if you can make something small, if as long as you know your geometry, you can scale it up one-to-one. And some of these, if you see some of the kind of basalt or granite sculptures, they look totally lifelike. You look at them today and, you know, and often they've lost their face, but ones that retain their faces that are made with hard stone, they look exactly as they did back then. And they're perfect recreations of the human face, only that they're, you know, six times bigger than this ceiling. They're just gigantic things. Their most famous creations, like the Great Pyramids of Giza. I really like this image. You can see the size of the blocks. They're not as smooth as you'd think they'd be. Each one of those is about the size of a person, to give you a sense of the scale. But they could build these gigantic pyramids. And the pyramids, like the obelisks, are all kind of love songs to geometry, pure lines, the kind of manifestations of these things. They tied this to the idea of pharaohs and rulers. So their pharaohs became living gods, embodiments of abstract powers. It's no coincidence that the word for ruler, as in the thing that you use to draw a line, is the same as the ruler of a country. You find that that goes all the way back through different languages, that there's a continuation of, not every language has it, but if you go back through Latin and Greek and things like that, and the Egyptians had it, there's a concurrence of the idea of rule as being the correct rule, following the rules, and a ruler and the straight line rule. All come from the same point, which is the idea that if you have the correct sense of proportions and order and stability, that will give you right rule in your life as well. So this is King Tut, famous King Tutankhamun. You can see the amount of gold that was embodied on him. They've always got these staffs, which are, you know, straight line rulers. He's carrying some of these animistic totem animals on his head. They've got these straight lines and the geometrics of his head coming out, turning his head into a series of shapes, triangles, spheres. Even more dramatic, you can see it in Queen Nefertiti. Nefertiti, who is essentially a living obelisk here. They've not even given her rounded shoulders. They've cut her shoulders off so that they're totally straight and flat. The particular body types that Egyptians like fit with this idea of straight lines as well. If you compare it to the Willendorf Venus, who's this big round body that's very sort of fecund, is nature in its kind of most, fully fleshed. Here they've got this stripped back, so they're very skinny, geometrical faces, huge like cheekbones, very thin, narrow faces. The women tend to have like boyish bodies kept in by very straight, sort of flapperish robes, whereas the men tended to be a lot more kind of triangular. So they were muscular, but not in like that Greek type of muscle where it's all, you know, bulging biceps and things. They said instead looked like kind of triangle chests and then sort of very straight legs. And the ideal man, like the ideal woman, was defined by their geometry. And this huge pillar that comes out of her head, the headdress thing, there's a suggestion that that was probably hiding an elongated skull as well, which we'll see in a second was something that they used to do to the pharaohs, was bind their skulls to make them longer, so that the human body itself was being made to fit with their ideals of beauty and style and proportion. And so we see the birth of style in Egypt. These particular beads that they wore would be very sort of thick, so that they would have that 1980s look where, you know, you've got very rigid shoulder pads. It makes you look very square and geometrical. Again, there's this kind of tight-fitting, sort of very rounded, featureless dress that they'd wear a lot of gold, a lot of jewelry that was very kind of hard wearing. There's the big circle on the head again, on the headdress. And even their own bodies they would change to bring into line with this particular view of how the world should be. So here's a very, very exaggerated, admittedly, this is a really extreme case of elongated heads. That's a little bit more what you would normally get. As soon as the baby is born, they bind the skull, and because the skull is quite plastic at that point, it pulls it out. And so the high priest class and the aristocrats and the pharaohs would have this long skull shape, which for the Egyptians was kind of fit in with their idea of art and style. You also had the Eye of Horus there, tattooed right onto the throat. So if you remember that breath, that's life, that's the kind of magical idea of life, they would tattoo the Eye of Horus onto the throat in the hope that your very last breath would send the Eye of Horus out from you so that you could go and collect all of your seven souls and bring them back to you. They would write that straight onto the body. They would also write onto weaponry. So weaponry could be given power by putting images and words onto it, which is a lot like, essentially, that drawing of those ancient animals and stabbing them with sticks. Here you've just taken the word and put it onto a weapon. That was something that was practiced much later on. So the Vikings had runes, which are just letters, and they would write onto it. Excalibur, King Arthur's sword, there's a suggestion that that was in fact an older myth about an Anglo-Saxon sword, because Excalibur is a Latinization of biter in Anglo-Saxon, and there was a lot of Anglo-Saxon weapons you would write onto them the thing you wanted them to be, and it would give them that power, this sense that you could kind of, that writing would imbue it with a power of its own. In fact, the ancient Egyptians used to do a thing where if you went to the doctors, if I went with a cold, they would write what you wanted, and then you could eat the writing, and they thought that that would cure you because it would give you the power hidden in the words, which, you know, they weren't totally advanced. The Eye of Horus, as this, again, circling back to it, is the core of that society was to do with view, giving all power to the eye, that the eye could establish order, could establish a kind of sense of meaning over the world. When you have these quite complicated golden constructions like this, you're seeing all sorts of elaborate religious things that are all brought together to try and explain a complex world, but putting them under this kind of all-powerful sense of order and stability. And so when we look at something like this, the kind of nice final image for our journey through ancient Egyptian civilization, we see these huge megalithic constructions that are filled with strange gods and strange images. All of it is giving us that core message of Egyptian values, which is that the individual and kind of individual nature is essentially subservient to these all-powerful eternal creatures, the gods, and the eternal rules of geometry. Because that's one thing that is very clear in Egyptian culture, is that the individual does not matter. Even individual pharaohs don't matter. The pharaohs only matter in the sense that they are embodiments of a higher ideal. They weren't building for themselves, they were building for eternity, because they didn't think there was ever going to be an end. They thought that all time was circular. And so they built with stone, they built with, you know, they wore metal, they wore and built with things that would last forever, that wouldn't fall to bits, and they're still here today. And they built on such vast scales that it would never fall down, because they weren't building for themselves or even for their children's children. They were building for forever, and this idea of there being an eternal order to the universe. And that eternal order gave them their power. It allowed them to move from a culture to a civilization, but it was also what undermined that civilization and turned them into these stultified kind of ossified, mummified creatures that couldn't respond when progress came a-calling in the form of the Romans. So finally, we'll look at this nice chair. This is what the pharaoh sat on. And we can see how Egypt is fascinating for a number of reasons. It's the bringing of the world into a modern conception of art, geometry, and style. It's the first true civilization in the sense of it being a kind of, even though there's other great collections of people around, this is the first kind of one that has a whole total vision of the world. It shows that art has power, and this power allows us to transcend our own limits, living on after we die, exerting control over those that we've never met, and leaving the bounds of nature entirely. It tells us that order, proportion, and right rule is the core of visual, political, and philosophical stability, but that stability in and of itself is not necessarily the be-all and end-all of things. So, boom, 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 boom.